Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Trigger warning. This episode contains conversations about mental health challenges in a young child, including depression and self-harm, which may be distressing for some listeners. Please take care while listening. In the 21st century, I often find it difficult to understand why we continue to perpetuate traditional roles and expectations of men and women. For decades, we've been calling for equality and equity, yet the same stigma associated with gender roles pervades. After my conversation with Michael Ray in episode 7, it became very clear that as a society, we remain stuck in a 1950s mentality that's supported by advertising and product marketing. Women are portrayed as the homemaker and caregiver, when in truth, there are more and more men stepping into that role for various reasons. Former aerospace executive Alex Eagler recognised that he and his wife were in way too deep with their high-powered jobs, working 50 hours a week as their family grew. Sharing the care initially through parenting leave, Alex chose to leave his industry to create a business that allowed him to be the lead caretaker. It hasn't been easy. However, the experiences have allowed Alex, who's a career and EQ coach, to get through some of the most difficult challenges. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I've been exploring parenting roles, and when I saw your posts on LinkedIn, I was intrigued by your story and inspired by your values. What challenges have you faced when making the decision to put your family first?
It really wasn't a big deal. I don't think, certainly never encountered anyone who treated me differently or I felt like they were judging me for it. The hardest judgment actually came from myself. It wasn't really, the masculinity was part of it, but it was much more around being the provider, the breadwinner, the person who makes the money. My family line was very intensely focused on that, on the male side. So my dad and my grandfather had really equated their job with being a dad as their job with being a financial provider specifically. And so it was untangling that part of my identity that was actually the hardest, and feeling like if I'm not making money, I'm not doing a good job. I'm not holding up my end of the bargain for really for them. I mean, the head start they gave me in that area, and then not following through and living up to my potential. And it took a lot of work sort of on myself to get through the part of, no, I'm doing what my family needs, and that's what being a dad is. And sometimes it looks like one thing and sometimes it looks like another. So the masculine part of it, I didn't struggle with too much, and I certainly haven't encountered it that I know of. Maybe it's happened behind my back, but I really haven't had any trouble with that, fortunately.
Well, in Australia, the culture is slightly different, and yes, men can often cop flack for doing a woman's job. Now, I find this very difficult to reconcile in today's age, but how did your experience give you an insight into how some women must feel leaving careers to raise children?
Yeah, it's one of the things that I think is the most interesting is certainly it's much more commonplace, you know, all over the world for the women to be the one who step away, who step back. And I get it, especially because right after the birth, the physical toll, the emotional toll, all of that is so much greater. And having seen my wife go through some just phenomenal challenges and having to bounce back and then go back to work, you know, 14 weeks after having you know, twin babies that were literally 16 pounds of baby between the two of them was phenomenal and incredible to watch. So I get sort of why that, from that trajectory, right? Right afterwards, the mother needs that space, that time and support. And then to sort of make the switch is hard. I really didn't understand it. My wife always says that I didn't become a dad when my son was born. I became a dad the week that I started my paternity leave with him. So she stayed home for the first 14 weeks. Then I took off time and she went back to work. And so she handed me this baby on Monday morning and off she went. And she said, you know, on Monday morning, I was so nervous. I was terrified. I was just, you know, she told me all the things I needed to do, but I just didn't have any confidence. And that, you know, from 1 week, literally, of just her going to work, coming home, going to work, coming home, when she got back on Friday afternoon, she was like, you were a dad. You know, none of that fear was there. You knew how to do it. You'd gotten through the first week. There had been some, you know, hilarious disasters, but nothing dangerous. And you were just ready to do it. And I think that's so right, that opportunity to be not just take time with my son, but actually be the one who's the lead caretaker. It was my job to figure out when he needed to eat, when he needed to sleep, how to change the diapers. All of that really did push me into that sort of next level. And I think it's not necessarily common, even among dads who take paternity leave, to take full advantage of that opportunity. And I feel like that's really where I kind of got that understanding of what mothers are going through and just the mental load of, okay, I have to think through every element of the schedule. If we're going to leave the house, are we going to be back in time for nap? Do I have enough, you know, milk to drink? All of that stuff. If you don't really take it on, you don't perceive it, right? You don't understand all the work that's going on in the background.
Yeah, there are some similarities to managing high-powered, you know, corporate positions, you know, when you're talking about managing raising children. And I think when you mentioned before about the identity crisis you went through, you know, who am I? I'm not working. I'm not earning money. I don't have a title. I'm, you know, dad. Women go through that too. I mean, I had been a very independent person prior to having children myself, and then I quickly became a single parent. So for me, even leaving my career before I took on my own business, I had an identity crisis. I think we go through that quite regularly. So why choose coaching as part of your, you know, new career trajectory?
I had been an aerospace engineer and I had sort of thought that's what I was always going to do. I liked it just fine. And kind of through the journey of having kids, I sort of realized that my strength wasn't actually in the designing of airplanes. I was pretty good at that, but the company I worked in was actually a startup, very high powered, had lots of really smart people, and came to understand that what I was particularly good at was relating to people, mentoring, helping to understand what was holding them back, and then getting them through that so they could keep working. I did much better in sort of a support capacity than sort of the lead or, you know, taking on the work and working independently. So I had always said I never wanted to be a manager. I never wanted to move up the ladder. And an opportunity came along and I said, well, maybe I really should. Maybe that's where I belong. And it turns out the job was more stressful when I got promoted to be a manager. And then eventually I got promoted all the way up to executive and reporting to the CEO. It was actually easier for me to do the job, though, because the things I was doing all day were the things that I was good at. It was thinking through sort of people problems. How do I help this person get through this challenge? How do I make sure they're engaged in their job? How do we rearrange the schedule so that we can meet the needs of, you know, the company, but also not put too much pressure on my team? And that was really easy for me. It used sort of the things that were unique. And I understood the engineering well enough that I could communicate with the team and they all trusted me. They knew I knew what I was talking about. And I realized that was the piece of it that I loved. It wasn't the aerospace engineering. That was just kind of the entry point. It was really the people and mentoring. So I thought that when I got into coaching, when I first started my business, it was going to be all around sort of communication and emotional and intelligence for people in engineering and software development, because I'd seen there was a real great need for that. And I felt that I could probably contribute in a way that a lot of other people couldn't. And that may be true, but there were also a lot of other people who were building around that idea. So I moved into career coaching because I literally had a friend of mine say, you know, that feeling you had after you had your first son, where you kind of showed up at work again after your leave and looked around and said, I don't know why I do this job. I can't do this another day. Like, this just doesn't work for me. That's how I'd left and actually gone to the startup in the first place. And she said, I'm having that exact same feeling right now. My son is 6 months old. I just went back to work and I don't want to do this job. I'm not going to last. I can tell I need something new, but I don't know why. I don't know where this is coming from. I was perfectly happy before. So can you tell me what you did to figure out how to sort of get past that? And that clicked the light bulb in my head of, oh, that wasn't a unique me thing. That was actually a pretty common parenting thing. So I made a sort of coaching program around the things that I thought helped over the decade that I had gone through, and went through it with her, and she found it very useful and went out and found a job. And then I started posting about it and talking to people. And sure enough, there were a lot of people who had similar shifts around, now what I want to do is different. The mission for my company matters more. The impact I make is more important. The way I spend my time is more important. And the common advice that I see on LinkedIn around that, which, you know, you and I both sort of agree with, is, well, you have to go start your own company. Then that's the only way it can work. And I get that. But I also spent a decade figuring out how to do that inside a company, because I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur who was going to go do that. So I want to help people who have that same feeling, but are completely against ever starting their own company. How do I find a job that allows that? How do I find the companies that value that, and then, you know, first line managers who are able to accommodate that, so I can contribute and do what I do well and enjoy my job, but also care about my family and be there when I need to for them also?
Well, I know you've been through some challenges, you know, within your family as well, with raising your children. And, you know, these things come along and rock us. How has your career coaching enabled you to be able to manage the things that have happened, you know, with your children a little bit better?
Yeah. So the main kind of point to it, starting this business and the realization that I wasn't going to go back to sort of the full-time manager or executive jobs that I had, was around my son really sinking into a deep depression after kind of a year and a half into the pandemic. And he had shown signs of anxiety, and in retrospect, maybe some depression too. He'd been in therapy for a long, long time. He was 9 years old at the time, and talking day in and day out about how he didn't know what the point of living was. He didn't see why there was any reason to go on. He tried taking his own life in a couple different ways, and just, it's hard to say this, but I'm kind of fortunate at the time that I didn't already have a job, because we needed full-time 24-hour. I mean, it was like having a newborn again. You know, he had to sleep in a bed with no sheets or anything. The doctor said you have to be very careful, right? If you can't give him anything that sort of he could do, because even though, and he'll sort of talk about this too, that he didn't really feel like he wanted to die. He just felt like he couldn't live anymore. But the thing about 9-year-olds and 9 to like 11 or 12 is a really dangerous age to have those feelings, because those kids don't understand sort of the limits of the human body and what it means. So they'll do things that are much more damaging than, you know, maybe kids that are 13, 14, 15 who are having those same feelings, but recognize, oh, if I do that, that actually will be sort of lifelong impactful. And this is just kind of a getting attention thing. So we had to be so careful. And that was when we sort of made the realization that we were going to need a different path, and it was going to have to, you know, come up quick. That's, you know, like you said, it really rocked what we had planned for everything. And so I started the coaching to try to make some money, but it was very focused on, well, what is it going to take? There are days when he woke up and just said, I can't go to school today. And so, okay, we'll make it work. Or days where, you know, we would send him off thinking we're definitely going to hear from the school today. And sure enough, they would call and say, he's not able to participate in class, or he's causing distractions for other students, and, you know, we need you to come down. So I became that, you know, on-call parent all the time, and trying to build the coaching business around it was a godsend that I even had that sort of option, you know, thanks to today's technology and, you know, social media and things like that, that I could do that remotely and have that flexibility. But it was backed into because my family and my son especially just needed so much care at that time. And he was having those problems at the same time. We have twins that were 2 years old and just going out into daycare at the same time for the first time. So they, anytime they got sick, somebody was getting sent home. So I think I counted in the first half of like 2022, I would have needed about 57 sick days to cover all the days between times that I had to help my son, my older sons, or times that my younger ones were not able to go to daycare. And that's just, there's no job that's going to give you that.
Unfortunately not. So you can see how things work out according to plan, I suppose. For me, the most triggering part of, you know, what you just told me, because I was unaware that your son had been through that, is that it reminded me of something that happened with my son at the age of 11. And I was alarmed, but the first thing I did was took action and found him some assistance when he expressed to me, you know, that he didn't want to live, and because I'd been through my own journey as well.
Yeah.
What role does neurodivergence feed into some of the things that have happened with you and your children?
Yeah. So at the time we had similarly, he had seen therapists, we found a psychiatrist, we had a whole team of doctors and people trying to help out and understand. And along the way, he got diagnosed, my oldest son got diagnosed with ADHD. And we understood where that came from, because there were certainly moments of impulsivity, but it really didn't feel like the right one to us. And we had, again, fortunately, a good enough care team. We had two different therapists that he was seeing at the time who both said, I've seen lots of kids who are ADHD and I don't see it. It's not, that's not what I would say here. Do not under any circumstances give them the medications for that, because I think they would go much worse. Things would get worse very quickly. And so we kept searching, and eventually his psychiatrist put together from a few different clues in places that, well, maybe this is bipolar and it just presents itself in a way that's, you know, at age 9 or age 10, it's just doesn't really look the way that you would sort of expect. So let's try that. And the main clue was he actually did end up having a really bad reaction to an antidepressant and became just raged all the time, violent. You know, if you triggered him at all, he would literally just attack. And we'd never seen that sort of behavior. He was never like that. And we were just blown away. We didn't know what to do. He was on the verge of getting kicked out of school, but they also knew this isn't your son. I mean, we've had him at the school for 6 years now, and we've never, or 5 years now, we've never seen anything like this. So we all kind of knew that something was going on, but it turned out that the bipolar and putting him on the meds for that made a huge difference. And within a few months, all of the sort of side effects of the previous medications had washed out, and he was back to somebody who could control his emotions. You know, even when they got big, he could kind of come back from it. And we hadn't seen that in years, and has made a huge difference. And so sort of understanding that, okay, this, we're on a different path with him, and what does that mean, and how do we support him through it? You know, I always say the bipolar label was so helpful because it got us to the medication. And then the next step is making sure that he understands that that's just one of the words that matters about who he is, because I think he feels a very strong identity pull towards that. It explains a lot of his life to him. But we also want to say, well, you know, you have these other strengths. You are an incredible actor and you love math and you're really good at lacrosse. All these other things to make him see himself as that full person, not just bipolar first.
Yeah, well, that comes back to identities, you know, and if we do have labels, some people, they don't like labels. And I see it a lot around social media, you know, why I don't need a label, I don't like labels, why do we need labels? But as you've just pointed out there, without understanding what your son was actually going through, how were you going to get any sort of medical assistance?
Right. Yeah, and I totally understand it. So we have another son who I would say I'd put a fair wager that will come out with some sort of neurodiversity diagnosis before we're all said and done. And for now, we've decided that we're waiting for it to manifest in a way that we can understand how to help him, as opposed to rushing out and getting the labels put on him too quickly. Because again, that was one of the problems that led us down a little bit of the wrong path with our older son was, okay, we need to get a name for this. And we got a name and we were like, no, that's not the right one. So I understand that. I see both sides. But for our oldest son, getting that label was literally the turning point. And I was pretty frustrated at the time because it took about 2 years for the psychiatrist to come up with that and figure it out. We did two rounds of different medications. And then I came to understand that diagnosing bipolar, especially in kids, especially in an 11-year-old, and this was an 11-year-old she'd never met, you know, through Zoom calls only, was actually a phenomenally incredible job. And that a lot of people go into their late teens, 20s, even 30s before they get that bipolar diagnosis. And then the whole world starts to make sense, right? Then they get medication that actually starts to address the real problems they've had. So I kind of flipped my expectations from the dad of how did you not figure this out sooner to, oh, now that I look around, we're actually really lucky how quickly we got to this and got on the medication that has just completely changed him back to the sweet little boy that we knew when he, you know, before all of this kind of happened.
How old is he now?
He's 12.
So given he'll probably be entering the workforce within the next 7 to 10 years, what do you hope for us as a society changes in the meantime so that he's more readily accepted and doesn't have to explain labels or be understood, you know, like as neurodiverse compared to neurotypical?
Right. We talk about this, and I think we're starting to see even the edge of it right now in his life in terms of how he talks about it with other, you know, with his peers. Some of them he'll readily tell, oh yeah, well, I'm bipolar, so of course I did that. But there are also some cases where he holds it back and says, I don't really want to share it with them. And understanding, seeing that kind of play out. And I've talked to him about my sharing it. And he says, oh, Dad, you know, I know that there are other families out there struggling. And if you telling my story will help them, then that's fine. And I said, well, you know, some people may find this out through this and hold it against you or say things about you. And he said, that's true. And he said, wouldn't have cared about those people's opinion anyway. So we'll just not worry about it. And I was like, well, that's pretty good for an, you know, 11 or 12 year old to say. But it is interesting to see that playing out. And I think he's starting to see the nuance in it of, this is important to understand so I can do my best, but also other people don't necessarily know what to do with it sometimes. So he's in a program at his school that is focused specifically on emotional and mental health challenges, and it's separate from sort of the special education around, you know, academics. So he does extremely well in academics, like grades ahead of where he is. So he doesn't need that kind of help. He just needs help. When you get dysregulated, how do you bring yourself back? How do you at least contain it so that it's not something that spreads out and disrupts the rest of the class? And how do we work on those skills? And I mean, the program has been amazing, but he does encounter kids who say, why do you go to that classroom? Because a lot of the other kids need both, right? They are kids who have both emotional challenges or mental health challenges and academic. And they're kind of like, you're not in that category. And he said, no, I am. I don't need the academic help. So I think, you know, to kind of get back to your question, I'm seeing that play out and how he's handling it very mindfully and who he shares and how he does. And I think what I would hope is that the world becomes a place where he feels more comfortable sharing it more and more, and that he doesn't worry about the stigma associated with it as much, that he's able to just say, this is who I am. And so to successfully do what I can do, this is what I need. And to have the world move in a direction where that's just a regular conversation. And that's true of everybody, right? I mean, neurotypical people, some like to work, you know, crazy hours, and some, you know, would much rather work at home, and some need to be in an office surrounded by people. And to me, it just seems like we learned so much about what was possible during the pandemic in terms of flexibility and making accommodations to a situation that we never expected. I wish we would just take those lessons to heart a little bit more and say, if you're the right person for the job, we'll figure out how to make it work.
Alex, it's been amazing. Your story, honestly, this is what captured me through the stories you share on LinkedIn. And I'm seeing so many more great storytellers in that space now, authentically connecting with their audience, regardless of it being a business platform. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really look forward to another conversation with you. I think we've got a lot to explore.
Thank you so much, Kim.
Lead dad of four, career and EQ coach Alex Eagler, helping parents navigate careers and family from California in the United States. You'll discover more about Alex online via his website, empatheticegg.com, or follow him on LinkedIn for inspiring content. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening. Remember to be the change you want to see. If you'd like to join my community, go to my website, kimclyden.com, to subscribe or follow me on socials by searching for What We Teach Our Children. Next week, it's a packed studio talking tech and wellness. Join Andy, Trent, and Jet as we dive into entrepreneurship, combining apps with access to health infrastructure.